Okay, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, Erica. Thank you. My name's Erica. I'm an alcoholic. If you don't mind, I want to just take a moment of silence right now so I can invite my God to be here and do for me what I can't do for myself. So I'll be right back. Okay. Again, Erica, alcoholic. So, my sobriety date is May 30th, 2007. I have a home group, I have a sponsor, and I also sponsor women in Alcoholics Anonymous. So those are my vital statistics. And usually what we do at the podium is we tell a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I have about 35 years of drunkalog. So we'd be here all night if I told you all the gory details of that. But I do want to tell you what it was like for me when I was drinking and using, because there might be some people that are new or fairly new that, you know, can relate to that. And because I know that's what helped me when I first got here, was I heard people that had gone through the same things or felt the same way that I did when they were drinking and using, made me feel like, oh, I was in the right place. So I will tell you that I grew up, I was born in San Luis Obispo. I'm 11 and 12 years younger than my brother and sister, so I was kind of like an only child. My parents were nice people. There was not abuse in the home. There was alcohol in the home, but it wasn't abused. My mother's side of the family is Swiss-Italian, so it was very common to have wine with dinner. And when I was really little, my mom went back to work, and my grandma used to babysit us. She used to help get my brother and sister off to school, and then she would babysit me. And on really cold mornings, she would make this homemade eggnog that she called Muya. It was just like a frothed egg and milk, and she would put a little coffee in there, and on really cold mornings she'd put a little shot of whiskey in there for us, and you put a little nutmeg on top, and that's what you had, and you dunked your toast in that, and that was just normal. There wasn't anything wrong with that, and it worked really well to make you warm. And so my brother and sister would go off to school, and then I would stay with grandma. And as I got a little older, my brother and sister, by the time I was about 8 years old, they were both gone to college. And I can remember at about 8 or 9 years old going clamming with my dad out at Pismo. I don't know if you're old enough, you remember clams out at Pismo. But he used to take me with him because I didn't need a fishing license because I was under 14. So he could get two limits of clams, and it would be legal. So he'd go out on the sandbars to get the big ones and stick me on the shore with my little pitchfork, and I'd be out there, you know, going through the motions of getting clams, and he'd gather all the clams, and then when we'd come in, he'd give me a little shot of, he called it sand dune cutty sark, which I later learned was scotch, but that was just to get you warm because it was really cold out there at 6 a.m. at low tide, you know. So, but that, and there was, and that was perfectly okay. That I didn't see anything wrong with that, and that didn't cause me to be an alcoholic, or I didn't start drinking. I mean, I didn't think about drinking all the time. I just knew that it worked really well to get me warm. It was like medicine. So, somewhere around the time I was 12 years old, I remember my parents went to a party in Arroyo Grande, and they took me with them because other grown-ups had their kids there too. And the grown-ups were partying, and the kids, some of the older kids gathered up some of the leftover booze and went up on the roof of one of the buildings at this place and made it like a suicide punch. And I remember being up there with them and feeling really grown up and cool because it was like the 16-year-olds and the and the 17-year-olds that were doing this, and they were including me in this. And so I remember drinking that punch with them. What I really remember is on the way home, throwing up out the window, and my mom being so concerned, saying, "Oh my gosh, I wonder what she ate that made her so sick." And I remember hearing my dad under his breath going, "It's not what she ate, it's what she drank." Mm-hmm. And they got me home and put me to bed. The next morning was Easter Sunday. They did not make me get up and go to church, thank God, because I was so hungover. But they had to have known what had happened, but they never said anything about it. In our house, those difficult conversations were just kind of swept under the rug. And I remember seeing the disappointment in my mother's eyes. She was really disappointed. And I thought to myself, well, I'm going to do this again, but this next time I'm going to be smart about it. I'm not going to throw up, and my parents aren't going to know about it. Because to me, that was just like really fun. The kids liked me. I felt I really liked what alcohol did for me that night. I don't remember any kind of magical thing happening. I just knew that I was going to do it again. I just had to be a little bit smarter about it. So I was still at a Catholic school at that point, and in eighth grade, I switched to public school. And because I was pretty sheltered, I guess, in a way, and I had grown up with all these same kids all this time and felt pretty comfortable, that when I was thrust into this new school, I was desperate to be popular and have friends. So I immediately sought out the cool kids, and wanted to do what they were doing. And, of course, they were smoking cigarettes, and some of them were smoking weed, and they were, you know, stealing beer or liquor out of their parents' liquor cabinet. So I, of course, needed to do that so that I could be a part of that group. And, you know, my parents had a full liquor cabinet full of liquor, because my dad would come home, he'd have a highball after work, and then a glass of rosé with dinner. And so that he was not an alcoholic by any, and when he for a while he was having two highballs, and he decided that that was like too much, so he cut it back to one. Yeah, beyond me. So I could steal some liquor out of the liquor cabinet and put a little water back in the bottle, make it look good. I don't know if anybody else thought of that, but I thought it was very clever. By the time, throughout high school, by the time I had my driver's license, I was, at all the keg parties. I learned that I could drink more than all of my friends and still be standing and coherent while they were puking and passed out. So I usually became the designated drunk driver to get everybody home. And that made me popular too. That way people would want to go with me because they knew that they could get a ride home. I'd take care of them and so that worked really well. And that's kind of how it went through high school. I majored in parking lot my junior year. But I managed to graduate with fairly decent grades good enough to get me into junior college. And so I decided I needed to get out of Santa Maria. Santa Maria was definitely no place to be. There was nothing to do, and I needed adventure. So my parents agreed to let me go to school in San Diego. And when I got to San Diego, how this happened, my roommates were exactly like me, especially Lucianne Reese. She was this rich girl from, I remember her name, I never know, but she was this rich girl from Newport Beach, and she didn't need to steal. She had all the money she needed, but her big thing was going in and stealing like Kahlua and all these really cool alcohols out of the liquor store, and then coming home and we'd have these parties. And I can just remember this one time waking up. I was late to class. My mother was on the phone, and they were trying to wake me up. I had been out partying the night before, and as I'm on the phone with my mom, I remember looking down at my leg, and I had this scrape mark on my leg, two parallel marks. And all of a sudden, I kind of vaguely had this recollection of climbing over a chain link fence. That was a tequila night in shorts. And so apparently I didn't make it completely over the fence without catching my leg, but I can remember being on the phone telling my mom, yeah, everything's okay, I just had the flu or something, you know, wasn't feeling good that morning, and looking down and going, oh my gosh, you know, what have I done? But to me, this is just as a result of the way I like to party. And there was nothing, you know, it wasn't any of any concern. It's just that's how I like to party. The next thing I realized, because this was back in the 70s, yeah, I'm very old. This was back in the 70s, and cocaine was coming on the scene in a big way. And my brother had a friend in San Diego that I met up with, and he became my connect for cocaine. And I found out real quick that I could have lots of friends, and people would want to come to my house and hang out with me, because I had the LSD and the cocaine and all the stuff everybody wanted. And of course, you know, that was my MO from the very beginning. I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be popular. I wanted you to like me. And I would go to, And it worked out great, because I like to party too. So as I went through college, you know, I managed to get grades, and I managed to go to class. I managed to get grades. I finished 2 years. I decided to change majors. Now I was going to be, I finished the general ed requirements. Now I was going to do pre-med. So I go to another junior college, and I have all these grand plans, and I actually did really well at that second college, and then I transferred to a university, and oh my gosh, all of a sudden, it was too much work. The work was getting in the way of my partying. So I, you know, somehow convinced my parents, well, this school wasn't exactly right. I needed to go to San Diego State, where mainly my classes were volleyball and art, and... And I just, you know, I don't know why they kept believing me, but I guess I was just, a high-functioning enough alcoholic that I could keep passing it off. But what was happening was, you know, the people that had been going to school, that I had been going to school with, now they were graduating and moving on. And I was still just kept, every time it would start to get to be work, I'd change my major or I'd change schools, because it would interfere with my partying. And so my companionship started getting lower and lower. Next thing I know, I'm involved with a guy that was an ex-con. His job was, I mean, he and his buddies, what they would do is they'd wait for drug deals to go down. And they'd go in and they'd tape everybody up and steal the drugs and the money. And and basically my job was, you know, to drive the getaway car and that sort of thing. And suddenly I'm doing things that, I mean, I was raised in a nice Catholic middle class home with good values and, you know, honesty and nice parents. And suddenly I'm driving the getaway car, and it's like, this is not what it was meant to be. So, and I was also, I mean, drinking is always a constant in my life, but I used a lot of other substances, and I used them in a variety of ways, to the point that I overdosed a couple of times. And luckily, you know, I'm still here to talk about it, but I, you know, addiction is a crazy thing. So anyway, I ended up in Puerto Rico, and then from Puerto Rico to St. Thomas, I had a job lined up. I tried to get my parents to give me some money to last me till I got my first paycheck. They wouldn't do that. They sent me a plane ticket instead, and I ended up coming back to Santa Maria with 64 cents in my pocket. I came back, you know, which I'd swore I'd never come back to Santa Maria, but here I was back again. And so I continued going to school, and I hooked right back up with some of the lowest companions that I knew in Santa Maria, and I just kept doing what I was doing. But I managed to get a job, a fairly decent job at the Santa Maria Times. But my drinking continued, my using continued, and it somehow I always managed to get to work. I managed, you know, to keep everything looking pretty good on the outside, but my life, it was crazy. I won't go into all the details. So fast forward a few years, one of my, I end up marrying, well, I was his dealer, and and he was married at the time that I got pregnant with our daughter, so that was a little messy, but he eventually left that wife and married me, and it, and you know what, I knew better. In my heart of hearts, I knew I shouldn't be marrying this person, but I was so deep in my disease that I didn't have the courage, the self-confidence to say no, because I was afraid of, you know, his reaction, and because I was in such denial that I really believed that I could somehow put a white picket fence around the whole thing. Once our daughter was born, I decided that it was probably I should give up the drugs because I, you know, I had this added responsibility, so I did. I didn't know anything about detox or NA or AA or any of that stuff. I just said, here, you hold the baby for a week, I'm going to sleep, and that's what I did. And when I detoxed from those drugs, I knew I wasn't ever going to touch them again, but I didn't quit drinking because drinking was socially acceptable. It was normal. I mean, we did it, you know, our family, and that wasn't my problem. Drugs were my problem. So I kept drinking. And, you know, for a long time, it was, you know, just kind of the normal, you know, going camping and, you know, we hung out with people that like to drink, and when we go camping and stuff like that, it all seemed pretty normal life for a while, but it started getting worse and worse, and I started to notice, and this is, gosh, my kids were probably, this is probably about the time they were in there in junior, well, Katie maybe 12, Cole about 8. I started noticing, like, on camping trips, like, we'd be sitting around the bonfire and everybody's drinking, and I would go into the motorhome and take a couple big swigs off the vodka bottle, because here in my mind what was happening is, since I always have been able to drink more than anybody else, what was happening is everybody else was getting too drunk too fast because they're all lightweights. So I needed to go drink more so that we could stay on the same plane, right? Does that make absolute perfect sense to you?
Absolutely.
Okay. See, it made perfect sense to me too. But it kind of occurred to me after a while, it kind of occurred to me that, you know, maybe that wasn't, you know, normal. Maybe that... maybe I did have a little problem, you know, because, and especially the sneaking part. So I, but I didn't give it a whole lot of thought. I didn't worry too much about it. That was about 5 years prior to the time when now my kids were a little bit older, and now my family started complaining that I was drinking too much, that I was kind of doing that Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde thing. I mean, everything would be fine, and suddenly someone would say something to me, and I would just flip out. Well, you know, if you worked full-time, did all the laundry, cooked all the meals, took care of the yard, you know, made sure everybody was everywhere, if you worked as hard as I did, how dare you say that to me, you know? So when I get home from work, if I've had a half a pint on the way home and another half a pint while I'm making dinner, you know, I deserve that, and how dare you suggest otherwise? So they started complaining that I was drinking too much, so I said, okay, fine, I'll stop. And, and that didn't work out so well. I may have quit I think I said I stopped for 17 days, but I think pretty much I cheated during those 17 days. I don't think I put together that much time. But what I did come, what came of that was I said to my husband, okay, here's the deal. I'll have 2 glasses of wine with dinner because that's normal, right? I can come home, have 2 glasses of wine, and that'll be it. So I'd have these 2 glasses of wine, which is about a half of a bottle. And then I put the other half of the bottle in the refrigerator. Well, now, this will drive me crazy because there's that half a bottle of wine in the refrigerator just calling my name, but I can't drink it because he'll know I've had more than my 2 glasses allotted wine. So now I start sneaking the vodka in between the sweaters in my closet upstairs, because this way I can run upstairs because I need something upstairs, go in, drink some of the vodka, and it still looks like I'm just having my 2 glasses of wine. No one can quite figure out how I get quite so drunk off 2 glasses of wine, but at least I'm able to continue to drink the way I need to drink, and everybody's off my back. Well, that worked for a while until they found the vodka in between the sweaters. So, all right, fine. I'll stop putting it in my closet. I've started. Now I came up with the brilliant idea to put the vodka in the water bottles in my car, which I thought was so genius till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and learned that everybody did that. So, one evening when Katie came home, and she came in, and I had just, I'd had my probably half a pint. Oh, this is what kills me. Okay, so, I'd get up in the morning pretty hungover and swear I wasn't going to drink that day, right? But by about 1 or 2 o'clock, I started to rehydrate, and I'd think, okay, I just, just a little bit to cut the edge and, level me out, and, so I feel good for the evening. So I'd go get a half a pint. Now, when I was sharing that with my daughter, she's like, who's a normie? She says, a half a pint, Mom? Do you realize that's 8 ounces? And I said, well, no, I never really thought of it like that. But to her, that's a lot. 8 ounces is a lot. And to me, that's the little bottle, right? That's not even very much. And she's like, Mom, because she was a bartender, that's like, 5 shots, 1.5 ounces a shot. And I'm like, oh, I never even thought of it that way. It's just like, that was just the little primer on the, yeah, right? Anyway, so I'm in the kitchen. She comes in. She says something probably benign, and I go crazy. I lose my mind. And next thing I know, we're in this argument, and I'm like, that's it. I'll just go kill myself. And up the stairs I go. We had a gun in the house. I knew where it was. I didn't know where the bullets were. But I'm like on my way up the stairs to get the gun and end it all. And she, yeah, I know, I'm very dramatic. And she calls 911, which she should have probably done. So they come and they arrest me and they take me to this place in San Luis. All I remember about it was that it had green walls and a really big nurse named Sue. And when I woke up in the morning, I was horrified because here I was in this place with paper slippers, green walls, and this nurse named Sue. So I guess that's what you call a 5150. And my husband called and said that he would let me get out of there if before the 72 hours was up, if I would agree to go to an AA meeting that night and call someone and ask them to be my sponsor. So I said, okay, I will, because I would do anything to get out of that place, and I didn't, So I called this lady named Tori, asked her to be my sponsor. She said, yeah, honey, okay, fine. I'll meet you at the Five Cities meeting. And I went to that meeting that night. That was December 14th, 2005. Now, I don't remember much about the meeting except that I remember thinking, oh, you know what, maybe there was some hope here. Because remember, I had tried to stop drinking on my own, and I realized I couldn't. And, you know, and I even got a little bit honest with myself at one point when I, you know, standing in the closet drinking, thinking, you know, this is how I'm going to die, because I knew by then I couldn't stop drinking. And I thought, if I could just stay alive long enough for my kids to graduate from high school, then my job as a parent is done. I can go ahead and die from alcohol. And I had been sent to Alcoholics Anonymous for a couple of DUIs I got earlier. And of course, I showed up and looked in the door and looked at all you guys and went, oh no, this is not going to work for me. And, you know, so in my mind, I just made it, you know, AA was not an option. It wasn't going to work. I had made that decision at the door one time. So when he said, you know, if I went to this AA meeting, I could get out of the nut house, I said, okay. But I did come away from there with the idea that maybe there was a way I could stay sober. So I kept going to meetings. I went almost every day. I read the book a couple of times, and I really started to like Alcoholics Anonymous. I read that book, and my gosh, I found myself in it. And this really made sense, and I thought, this is a really great program. But the problem was, is that I was just a little bit better than you all. I wasn't the kind of alcoholic that you are. I was the kind of alcoholic that I could, you know, AA had some great stuff, and given that information and my high intellect, I could figure out how to do this my way. So I, you know, and my husband kept saying, if you just quit drinking, everything will be better. Well, at home, I had quit drinking, but everything was not better. And he was not supposed to be drinking in the house. He had a shop out back, but of course, he wasn't an alcoholic. So, and he didn't keep it out of the house. So, you know, when he would make a drink in the downstairs bedroom, I mean, I could walk in 10, 20 minutes later to that room and smell the alcohol. And because, you know, any good alcoholic can find the booze. So I, you know, after about 5 months of sobriety, I thought, you know what, I'm going to just prove to myself that I could drink like a normal drinker. So I took a drink off of that bottle on a Wednesday, and lo and behold, that's all I had. I had one drink, and then I didn't have another drink for a whole week. And then the following Wednesday, I had two little drinks. And I was like, this is really working. You know, I am going to be able to do this AA thing, because now I can just, you know, drink like a normal drinker. Well, guess how long that lasted? Not much longer. By about the following Saturday, I was at the store buying a bottle and drinking like I always drank. So I went in and out of AA for about another year before finally Labor Day week, you know, Memorial Day weekend. I was sober. I had been going to an outpatient program. I had been sober for about 45 days. I have no idea why I went to the store that Thursday, but I bought a big old bottle of vodka. I stashed it in the garage, and that was the beginning of a 4-day blackout. And that was my last drunk. You know how they tell you in here, don't forget your last drunk? Well, I can only remember bits and pieces of it, because it was pretty much a 4-day blackout. I ended up being taken to Arroyo Grande Hospital, then transferred down to Santa Barbara to 5 East to another psych ward for detox, and then I ended up at Cottage Residential Center for rehab. They told me that insurance was going to pay for it, so don't worry, because I didn't want to go. And insurance did pay $20 a day. Yeah. But in retrospect, that was probably about the best $15,000 I ever spent, because I've been sober since. What happened when I got there was that I realized finally after that four-day blackout that, you know what, and after a year and a half of going in and out of AA, that I had tried every imaginable remedy. I had tried every sort of self-deception and experimentation to prove like that I could drink like a normal drinker, and I just couldn't. The proof was in. I couldn't, and I gave up. I was like, okay, I give. I know what I thought I knew. I decided I didn't know anything, and I was willing to listen to what you had to say. So that's when I began to be able to hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got busy working the steps. I got a sponsor while I was in rehab. Didn't know her, but I got her name from someone that I knew through business as a business associate. She agreed to sponsor me. She met me. She put me right to work. A lot of you know, I didn't know her when I chose her, but she ended up being the best sponsor for me. And a lot of you remember Peggy. She was a no bullshit kind of woman, and that's what I needed. Because the first time I met her, I told her about how abusive my husband was, and you know, I was so fragile. And she said, "Honey, I understand what you're saying, but he's not the problem. Alcohol's your problem." And I was like, oh, all right, I guess that's not going to work on her. So I started working the steps and doing what she told me to do. If she told me to call a newcomer, I called a newcomer. If she told me to wash coffee cups, I washed coffee cups. If she told me, you know, to work this, to write about it, and she's constantly telling me to write about it, I wrote about it. I did what she told me to do. And I got the steps done within about the first 5 or 6 months of my sobriety. I was still living with my ex at the time. I'd made a commitment to stay there at least a year, but I managed to stay sober even though he tried everything he could to sabotage my sobriety. I managed to stay sober. And after I'd been, after a year of sobriety and I had a good firm foundation, the kids and I moved out. And that was an ugly, ugly situation, but I stayed sober, and you know what I did? I kept in contact with you. I had people from AA come over for parties. I came to meetings. I was of service. I think I was an IGR. I washed coffee cups. I got as involved in AA as I possibly could, and just kept my focus on my sobriety. I figured if I could keep my sobriety, everything else would work out. That's what I was told. If I made my sobriety my number one priority, everything else would work out. And I was willing to believe that. So that's what I kept doing. And that was, that was a while ago. And, you know, I have to say that there have been lots of times, ups and downs and that sort of thing. But what I remember standing at the podium on my first birthday and just saying, you know what, I didn't do this. You know, a power greater than myself did this because I was not capable of staying sober on my own. It had to come from a power greater than myself. And today, when, you know, I have to do that I have to continue to do that because, you know, staying sober is not as tough today for me because it just doesn't, when stuff happens, I don't think about drinking, but I definitely think about acting out on my character defects. You know, I definitely think about behaving badly. And that's not the person I want to be today. I want to be someone that I can feel good about because for the longest time, and when I got to AA, I hadn't lost everything, like material stuff, but man, I had lost my self-esteem, my self-respect, my integrity, you know, all the lying and cheating that has to go on to sneak being a drunk, you know, even when my work didn't know, they were like, you're going to rehab, you know, that's a lot of work, and that just, you know, that was a soul, my soul was like dead, and I wanted to start to feel good about myself. So, you know, that's why today I still have to ask on a daily basis for God to be with me, to direct my thinking, and to do for me what I can't do for myself. Because He has from the very beginning, and sometimes I forget that I can rely on that higher power to help me be the person that I would like to be. Not the person that comes out when, you know, stuff gets complicated, but the person that I would like to be. And that's as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, so you know what? I have a lot more time to talk, don't I? Only if I want to. It's my time. Well, let's see. What can I tell you? The truth is good. Yeah, thanks, Angel. Thanks for that. You know, I want to talk about the fourth step a little bit. I don't know how you all do it, but this is kind of what I was taught. I did a fourth step with my sponsor, and it was really eye-opening for me, because I can live in denial. That's my happy place, is in denial, definitely. But it's not very practical, because reality is reality, and when you're in denial, you're not dealing with the truth. So the fourth step was really an eye-opener for me, where I could start to see, you know, my selfishness, my arrogance, my, you know, my insecurities, some of my fears, the things that drove me to do the things I did. And of course, that helped me with 6 and 7, and that it also helped me with 8 and 9. But along the way, there have been times, and it tells us on pages 63 and 64, it makes it pretty clear that resentment is pretty not a good thing for alcoholics. I mean, it may be the dubious luxury of other normal people, but for alcoholics, we got to steer clear of that, because if we don't, we're going to drink. That's what the book says. And it really actually threatens our lives a couple of times in there. So what my sponsor, my original sponsor, had me do, and my current sponsor has me do sometimes, when things come up, I can do a mini fourth step. Like, I can do a fourth step just on that particular item. I can, or whether it's a person, place, or thing, and I can list all the things that they've done wrong, and all the reasons I'm so upset, and all the reasons, you know, how it's affecting me, and then find my part. And when I can find my part, okay, now I can remember that, you know what, I did have a part in it, but I can also remember to look at that person, as the book tells us, as also being sick. I have to remember, I'm not perfect. And when I can look at my part, then I'm reminded I'm not perfect, and so I can't expect you to be either. I can pray for you. I can try to forgive you. And I was just talking earlier about this. It's like, you know, when I have a resentment and I am so mad at you, I'll give you a perfect example. So that ex-husband of mine, man, I hated him. I hated him a lot. And this is how I know that I couldn't let go or forgive him, is because every time, and he lived up in Arroyo Grande, but every time I'd see a car like his in Santa Maria, just get that, feeling like, look and see if it was him, just so I could maybe, you know, flip him off or something. And you know, he's going along living his happy life, got married a couple more times. You know, he doesn't know that I'm like seething every time the thought of him crosses my mind. So it's eating me up. It's not hurting him at all. Well, I went to this, it was a dream therapy or a dream workshop or something like that. It was kind of crazy. It wasn't like where you go, we would meditate, and it wasn't like the guy would read your dreams or tell you what your dreams meant, but it was more about the feelings of your dreams and what the subconscious was telling you. And at one of these sessions, what I came out of was having this really new kind of deep compassion for myself that I had never had before. It was kind of like forgiving myself for some of the things I had done as, you know, a child and as a teenager. And I was it was really kind of a great, great feeling to be able to begin to forgive myself for some of the stuff I felt crappy about. I felt a lot of guilt and shame over. And as I'm driving to San Luis one day, and I'm praying and I'm saying, you know, thank you, God, for, you know, this newfound compassion, and allow me, you know, to show that same compassion to others. And God says, even Steve? And I'm like, fuck no. not him. But I realized that that was exactly what I needed to do. And so that was like on a Sunday. On a following Tuesday, I'm at my office and the phone rings, and I can see on the little caller ID thing that it's him calling. And I'm like, okay, have compassion. He's probably calling about one of our children. They are his children also. Have some compassion. So I picked up the phone and spoke with him, answered his questions or whatever. And when I put the phone down, I noticed that I didn't have that bunched up feeling anymore. I wasn't like all, ooh, I just had to talk to him, you know. I didn't have that feeling anymore. It was like I was free. And not to say that I really like him a whole lot anymore, or that I trust him to be any different than he was before, because he's still pretty much the same person. But I am friends with him now. I can have conversations with him now. We can be at the same place when our children are having, you know, a birthday party, or, you know, there's some kind of family gathering. And it is a gift to my kids. I mean, my daughter has said, Mom, you don't know how much it means to me that you and Dad, she goes, you guys get along better than you ever did when you were married, which is true. And it's as a result of this program and, you know, my continuing to try to grow spiritually, which is what our book also says, is that all we have to do is be willing to practice these principles in all our affairs. We want spiritual progress, not perfection. And as a result of that, I'm able to give that gift to my kids and be able to be in the same room with him without wanting to kill him or be all, you know, crazy. And I guess, you know, that goes on in a lot of families. So I'm grateful for that. I'm just happy to be sober. I will tell you this, if you're new, or even if you're not new, keep coming. From the very first time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, when I'd see people relapse, go out, and then if they made it back in, always you say, well, what happened? Well, I quit going to meetings. That's the first thing everybody always says. So I don't want to go back to where I was during that four-day blackout and to that soul sickness that I felt then. You know, life may not be perfect all the time, but it's a hell of a lot better than it was. And so I'm just going to keep coming back. I hope you do too. And thanks for letting me share.